Howdy, friends. This is Matt Sewell, and you're listening to a very special episode 95 of the Popecast, the only podcast about popes where you'll find non-boring stories on the successors of St. Peter, and a reminder that all the world's problems have happened plenty of times before. Quick note before we get into it, don't forget to check out our other papal history project called Today in Papal History. It's a periodic newsletter telling the story of what happened on a given calendar day in the 2000-year history of the papacy. You can find that at popes.substack.com. That's popes.substack.com for free, or you can upgrade to a paid subscription for more cool stuff. And then also, you can also find this on Patreon to support this show at patreon.com/thepopecast. On to the show. Our Pope this week was in the chair of Peter for barely a moment in the great lifespan of Catholic history, but his humble heart and joyful demeanor has influenced each of the three popes that have followed him and put him firmly among the most memorable and beloved pontiffs of the last several centuries. And yes, this is the second time we've covered him on the show, but he deserved a refresh. After all, on the day that this is being released, September 4th, 2022, our Pope will be beatified by Pope Francis in Rome. So this week on the Popecast, with the usual bio, plus a couple of other surprise fresh cuts, it's the other Pope named John Paul, number 263, blessed Pope John Paul I. Albino Luciani was born on October 17, 1912, in the town of Forno dei Canali in northern Italy. He was the oldest of four children born to his parents, Giovanni and Bartolomea. He had two half-sisters from his father's previous marriage, and his life was almost over before it even began. In fact, the midwife who delivered Albino ended up giving him an emergency baptism the same day after considering him to be in danger of death. His baptism was formalized at his parish church 2 days later, for what it's worth. His was a poor, working-class family, though. Albino's dad was a bricklayer who often had to find work abroad, and so he left his mother to sadly care for the children alone much of the time. Albino's mom, no surprises here, was particularly devout. Italian Catholic mother, I mean, it's pretty par for the course. Reportedly, she was even being considered by her friends before marriage to likely become a nun, and only agreed to marry the somewhat lax Catholic Giovanni on the condition that he would encourage their children in being brought up Catholic. By all accounts, Albino Luciani lived a normal Catholic upbringing, one that would be recognizable memory for many of us even today. Rising early for Mass, frequent recitation of the family rosary, taking in the smells and bells of the parish church. Albino said years later that it was both the word and the example of his mother that helped him never to forget the lessons she taught him in that regard. And Raymond and Loretta Seebeck wrote in their book, The Smiling Pope, quote, "All his life, he retained the most tender affection for her." End quote. And yet, Albino was supposedly a rather rambunctious kid. The Seebecks recount a story in their book from his brother Eduardo, who had said young Albino was, quote, "a high-spirited, mischievous child, full of pranks and given to pulling the girls' hair at school and fighting with his schoolmates." In fact, at an audience while Pope, he said laughingly that he hoped no one would look up his conduct marks during his elementary schooling because they were so bad. End quote. So there's hope for just about anybody, I guess. Even still, Albino was known to be a kind brother and friend as well. Growing up in the aftermath of World War I, their region suffered particular devastation and food was often scarce. One time when Albino was 8, he received a single slice of white bread as payment for doing a chore for a woman who lived nearby, something that was almost entirely foreign in those parts back then, the white bread, that is, not the chores. But instead of eating it, Albino brought it home and offered it to his brother, who said later that, quote, "he has never forgotten the taste and smell of that piece of bread," end quote. Albino's closest schoolmate, Giulio Brametza, spoke equally fondly of him, recounting that they would sometimes skip school to go into the mountains and catch birds, saying that any day they were able to catch goldfinches was a great day. Giulio and Albino remained friends into adulthood, and in 1945, when Giulio was imprisoned in a German concentration camp, Albino, then a young priest, somehow arranged for a radio to be brought to his friend so that he could relay a message to his frantic wife, who hadn't heard from him in over a year. Quote, "somehow Albino had succeeded in finding me," Giulio said. When Albino was 10, he attended a mission at his parish church given by Franciscan friars, and it was there that he felt his call to the priesthood. So strongly, in fact, that he apparently would have just left with the priest right then if his parents had let him. But his mother and the parish priest, however, said he must wait not only until he was 11, to enter the minor seminary, but also his dad needed to rubber stamp the move, something Albino was nervous about, considering the eldest son was expected to contribute to supporting the family upon coming of age. But to his great surprise and delight, in a letter bearing a stamp with Mary emblazoned on it, Albino's father agreed with great enthusiasm. Giovanni's only caveat, he wrote to Albino, quote, "And I hope that when you are a priest, you will take the part of the poor and the workers, because Christ took their part," end quote. And so off he went. October 1st, 1923, 99 years ago, at the tender age of 11, Albino Luciani began his road to the priesthood. Always a bright child, despite being completely unaware of his own abilities, as one of his seminary professors would say, Albino excelled all through seminary life. Not quite 12 years later, he became Father Albino Luciani, being ordained a priest on July 7th, 1935, by the same bishop who had confirmed him as a boy. He had said his first Mass at his home parish in Canale and spent the first 6 months of his priesthood there to serve as curate, basically an assistant to the pastor. And from there, he was sent to teach at a college for minors, yes, minors, as an instructor of religion for 2 years, and then to the Gregorian Seminary in Belluno, Italy, as vice rector and seminary professor for the next decade. He was, by all accounts, a fantastic teacher of the faith, especially to children and young minds. His first pastor, Don Augustin Bramezza, said about him, quote, "I gave him the job of entertaining the children, and he did it splendidly. He was a genius in telling stories, and he always knew how to draw a significant moral from them in a very humorous way. The children gathered around him, listening with mouths open, hanging on his every word," end quote. He was a patient but insistent instructor who, despite being no pushover on discipline, was known well as the most level-headed of all the seminary's faculty, being cited often even as someone who always offered an open door and as much help as was needed. During those 10 years, Don Albino, as he was known then, taught a wide range of subjects, everything from dogmatics, philosophy, canon law, to the history of art, sacred art, and even catechetics. Outside of the classroom, he encouraged increased familiarity with mass media, printing, radio, and movies in particular back then, and perhaps even being ahead of his time in realizing the importance of the church leveraging such technology for the good of its members and for the spreading of the gospel. He also went to great lengths to encourage decorum, good manners, noting that it is absolutely essential to charity. He once even said on the topic, quote, "People greatly appreciate our courtesy and kindness. This is a little thing, but sometimes the success of our work depends on just these little things. Pay attention. Be kind and polite with everyone, but subservient to no one," end quote. In 1947, Don Albino received his doctorate in sacred theology from the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome, and was later that year appointed chancellor of his diocese and named Monsignor by Pope Pius XII. The title change came with an outfit change, as well, as some may know, but now Monsignor Albino wasn't too concerned. When a seminarian mistakenly still called him Don Albino and was yelled at by some classmates, he came to the boy's defense, saying, quote, "These titles are a farce. Men are like footballs. If the football is deflated, people ignore it and leave it in a corner. If it's pumped up, everyone thinks they can use it as they please and kick it around," end quote. In 1948, Monsignor Albino was appointed to head the catechetics office at the Diocese of Belluno, responsible for religious education and the passing on of the faith. And the following year, he released a book that translates into English as Catechetics in Crumbs, meant to form catechists to pass on the Catholic faith in a simple way, one would assume. So popular was it, though, for its simplicity and profundity that it was actually republished after his death by several Italian publishers. He would spend most of the next decade in that post, doing the job he loved really above anything else in his life as a priest. He would eventually be named Vicar General, number 2 to the bishop of his diocese in 1954, and was put in charge of the cathedral there in 1956. It was actually around this time that one Cardinal Angelo Roncalli came to Belluno to visit for a few days, one of which involved Monsignor Albino offering to drive the visiting cardinal around. The priest apparently made such an impression on Roncalli that when the latter was elected pope in 1958 as the now Saint John the 23rd, he soon found a new home for Luciani as bishop of Vittorio Veneto in northeastern Italy at the foot of the Italian Alps. Luciani, who had been somewhat sickly for most of his life, objected to the appointment, citing respiratory problems, even though we all know he just wanted to stay a priest. John the 23rd, though, having none of it, simply replied, "If that's all it is, the bishop's palace is high on a hill. The air is wonderful and will do you good." After accepting the new post, John the 23rd himself would consecrate Luciani a bishop 2 days after Christmas in 1958 in St. Peter's Basilica, 3 months, in fact, almost to the day after the future John Paul II was ordained a bishop in Poland. Luciani chose as his motto, Humilitas, the same as the great Renaissance figure St. Charles Borromeo, who Luciani considered a model bishop for his humility. He would attend all four sessions of the Second Vatican Council, which took place from 1962 to 1965, and he even made a few written interventions throughout the course of it. It was there also that he met and befriended the great Cardinal Stefan Wyszyński, primate of Poland at the time and mentor to the future John Paul II. In the book, The Smiling Pope, the Seebecks wrote that John Paul I gained a great appreciation for Poland and her people after that, saying, perhaps prophetically, quote, I am convinced that only the Polish Church can save us. I do not know how, but I'm certain that Poland has a great mission to fulfill. In the coming years, they will speak much about this nation, which is so devoted to Our Lady, end quote. If only he knew. Luciani served in Vittorio Veneto for a full decade, during which time he gained an endless adulation from the people there. When pilgrims from the diocese later visited Rome during the pontificate of John Paul II, the Polish Pope said to them, quote, how lucky you are, you who for so many years were able to enjoy the presence of such a good father. Toward the end of his time there, 1968 in particular, saw Luciani defending Pope Paul VI's release of Humanae Vitae, an opposition to endorsing the birth control pill for use in regulating births, being one of the first bishops in the world to circulate it widely to his priests, despite all of the unpopular press that came with it. When the Cardinal Patriarch of Venice died in 1969, Luciani was surprised to find himself on the move once again, but he was about the only one, given his growing popularity by that time. Of course, once again, he objected to the move with Paul VI as he had with John XXIII, but the sitting pope insisted yet again, saying that a man like him was needed in Venice. So he was installed in the new role in 1970 and was elevated to cardinal 3 years later, receiving the red hat on March 5th, 1973. Now Cardinal Luciani lived his life in Venice just as he'd done in past assignments, although now the posh Venetian served as a rather stark contrast to his simple existence. He would shirk much of the traditional trappings the Patriarch of Venice had been associated with in the past, only accepting invitations to public events that raised money for the poor, and refusing to leverage his prestige for anything beyond that. He insisted on making himself available to anyone who wished to see him, producing long lines of people outside his office almost daily. But those people included the poor and marginalized, laborers, those recently released from jail, former prostitutes, you name it, all people he counted as his friends. In all of this, an infectious joy and serenity was constantly on the countenance of Cardinal Luciani, even in tough or uncomfortable situations. He would say at one point, quote, it is not enough that I save my own soul. I must help others as much as I can. I will draw close to them with courtesy, with humility, full of respect for them, with the one desire to serve them, end quote. During his time as patriarch, most famously, he published the book Illustrissimi, a collection of columns he'd written for the Italian publication St. Anthony's Messenger, in the form of letters to famous people, obviously many of whom were already dead, but they were fictional and real, past and present, including among them Jesus himself, G.K. Chesterton, Mark Twain, and Charles Dickens, among many others. And since this is a special episode on John Paul I, here's actually just a few excerpts of those letters in particular. To Dickens, in his very first installment, he said, Dear Dickens, I'm a bishop and I've accepted the curious assignment of writing each month for the Messenger of St. Anthony, a letter to some illustrious figure. Pressed for time, with the Christmas season upon us, I really didn't know who to choose. But then, in a newspaper, I came across an advertisement for an edition of your famous Christmas books. I promptly said to myself, I read them as a boy, and I enjoyed them immensely because they are filled with love for the poor and a sense of social regeneration. They are warm with imagination and humanity. I shall write to him. And so here I am, taking the liberty of disturbing you. End quote. To Mark Twain, he had this to say. Dear Mark Twain, you were one of my favorite authors during my adolescence. I still remember the amusing adventures of Tom Sawyer, which, after all, are your own boyhood adventures, dear Twain. I have repeated some of your witticisms hundreds of times, the one about the value of books, for example. The value is beyond calculation. You once said to a girl who had questioned you, but it varies, a book bound in leather is excellent for sharpening a razor. A small book, concise, the sort that French write so well, is wonderfully used when wedged under the short leg of a table. A thick book, a dictionary, for example, is an ideal projectile for throwing at cats. And finally, an atlas, with its wide pages, has the most suitable paper for keeping a pane of glass from rattling. My pupils used to be delighted when I would announce, now I'll tell you another Mark Twain story. but I fear that the members of my diocese are shocked. A bishop who quotes Mark Twain. Perhaps it should be first explained to them that just as books vary, so are various kinds of bishop. Some, in fact, resemble eagles, soaring in masterly documents at the highest level. Others are nightingales, singing the praises of the Lord in a wondrous way. Others are poor wrens who, on the lowest branch of the ecclesiastical tree, attempt to express some notion on very vast subjects. I, dear Twain, belong to the last category. And so, summoning my courage, I will recall how you once remarked, in effect, that man is more complex than he seems. Every adult contains not one, but three different men. What do you mean? Someone asked, and you said, take John Doe. In him there is John the First, namely the man he thinks he is. There is John the Second, the man others think he is. And finally, John the Third, the man he really is. End quote. To G.K. Chesterton, he wrote, quote, the sense of justice that is in every man, of whatever faith, demands that the good done, the evil suffered, be rewarded, that the hunger for life innate in all be satisfied. Where and how, if not in another life? And from whom, if not from God? And from what God, if not from the one of whom Francis de Sales wrote, do not fear God in the least, for he does not want to do you harm, but love him greatly because he wants to do you great good. The one that many are fighting is not the true God, but the false idea of God that they have formed, a God who protects the rich, who only asks and demands, who is envious of our progress and well-being, who constantly observes our sins from above to enjoy the pleasure of punishing them. My dear Chesterton, you know as well as I, God is not like that, but is at once good and just, father also to prodigal sons, not wanting us poor and wretched, but great, free, creators of our own destiny. Our God is so far from being man's rival that he wanted man as a friend, calling him to share in his own divine nature and in his own eternal happiness. And it is not true that he makes excessive demands of us. On the contrary, he is satisfied with little because he knows very well that we do not have much. End quote. And lastly, to Jesus Christ, 4 years before Luciano would be elected to the papacy, he wrote, quote, at this spectacle of people rushing to a crucifix for so many centuries and from every part of the world, a question arises. Was this only a great, beneficent man, or was he a god? You yourself gave the answer, and anyone whose eyes are not veiled by prejudice but are eager for the light will accept it. When Peter proclaimed, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, you not only accepted this confession but also rewarded it. You have always claimed for yourself that which the Jews considered reserved for God. To their scandal you forgave sins. You called yourself master of the Sabbath. You taught with supreme authority. You declared yourself the equal of the Father. Several times they tried to stone you as a blasphemer because you uttered the name of God. When they finally took you and brought you before the high priest, he asked you solemnly, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? You answered, I am, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. You accepted death rather than retract and deny this divine essence of yours. I have written, but I have never before been so dissatisfied with my writing. I feel as if I had left out the greater part of what could be said of you, that I have said badly what should have been said better. There is one comfort, however. The important thing is not that one person should write about Christ, but that many should love and imitate Christ. And fortunately, in spite of everything, this still happens. End quote. So some words from John Paul I that I thought worth sharing. He had written that in the 7 years before he was elected to the papacy. But on August 6th, 1978, Pope Paul VI died after a pontificate of 15 years. 4 days later, Cardinal Luciani made for Rome. The conclave began a little more than 2 weeks later, commencing on August 25th. Cardinal Luciani was elected on the fourth ballot, the second vote of the second day, and the day prior had apparently been told by Cardinal Jaime Sin of the Philippines, quote, you will be the new pope, end quote. After accepting his election and saying to the cardinals present, may God forgive you for what you've done, one of those unspoken papal traditions, he said specifically to Cardinal Sin, you were a prophet, but my reign will be a short one. Cue the spooky music. Anyway, he took the regnal name of John Paul I, being the first pope in history to take two names, honoring each of the past two popes, of course, and also the first to intentionally put the first after his name. And that's curious. We'll get back to that a little bit later. Because, of course, notice Francis. Pope Francis is just Pope Francis. He's not Pope Francis I, and he insisted on that. What was most striking about the choice was how relatively obscure John Paul I was to the cardinal electors and the rest of the world. Many cardinals were listed as likely candidates, but only one that had Luciani listed was the one in northern Italy's papers, where he had lived as a bishop. And yet it was near unanimous among the cardinal electors that God's providence guided them to elect this smiling, humble man. Cardinal Wojtyła, soon to be John Paul II, said, quote, "God chose Cardinal Luciani. At first he kept him, so to speak, in the shade, and he himself, the predestined one, sought to be hidden. Then all of a sudden, the Lord revealed the face and name of him whom he had chosen." End quote. Cardinal Basil Hume of England had this to say after the conclave, quote, "Seldom have I had such an experience of the presence of God. I am not one for whom the dictates of the Holy Spirit are self-evident. I'm slightly hard-boiled on that, but for me, he was God's candidate." End quote. Now, the conclave itself, as a quick aside, was unique in a few ways as well. It was the first conclave in 150 years to have at least two future popes participating, and the first since 1721, following the death of Pope Clement XI, in which three future popes were among the voting members, of course, those being John Paul I, John Paul II, and Benedict XVI. John Paul's first acts as pope were to adjust some of the common trappings of the office of the papacy, ones which have been continued to this day. Among them were starting to use "I" to refer to himself instead of the royal "we" in papal documents, opting for a simple installation instead of the formal coronation ceremony, and he was the last pope to use the sedia gestatoria, the pre-popemobile chair, upon which the pope was lifted high and carried in order to be seen by crowds. He quickly earned himself the title of the Smiling Pope for that palpable joy which those who had already known him had become so used to and which was now being shared with the world. But for reasons known only to God, John Paul I's pontificate was over nearly as soon as it began. On the night of September 28th, just 33 days after his election as the 262nd successor of St. Peter, Pope John Paul I died, likely of a heart attack. He was found the next morning by one of his housekeepers, still sitting up in bed, with his reading light still on, glasses on the end of his nose, a slight smile on his face, and a few typewritten papers in his hand. Of course, with such a short pontificate and the Pope dying alone in his room, there have been no shortage of conspiracy theories of potential foul play over the years. Now, I love a good conspiracy theory, personally. I'm fully confident that there was indeed a second gunman on the grassy knoll, for instance. But when placed under scrutiny, whether it was JP1 being offed by the Mafia or the Freemasons or some such, all of them have more or less fallen flat. But even still, if you're curious, last fall we actually did an episode, if you remember, with our friends over at The Pillar on whether or not John Paul I was murdered. That one's well worth a listen if you haven't heard it or would like to refresh yourself on that front. But at any rate, the Pope, by all accounts, had died of natural causes, 3 weeks shy of his 66th birthday. John Paul I currently sits in a tie for 10th place in the list of shortest papacies in the history of the Catholic Church, and his death made 1978 just the 13th instance of a year of three popes in the history of Catholicism, that being a calendar year where three different men reigned as pope. But he was still able to make a lasting impact that's echoed through the ensuing decades. Even though John Paul I gave just 19 addresses during his short reign, the things he did preach and write about are packed with important insights into living a life of virtue and simply entrusting one's life to the Lord. So pivotal was the person of Pope John Paul I that his cause for canonization is not only underway, but as I mentioned at the beginning, is nearing its completion. It formally began in 1990 with a petition from the bishops of Brazil, of all places, where he had spent 2 weeks apparently as a cardinal in 1975 and clearly had made an impression. The cause moved forward in 2002 with a collection of documents and testimonies related to John Paul I's life, and the following year it saw the late pope receive the title Servant of God after the Vatican's Congregation for the Causes of Saints determined that there were no objections to the cause moving ahead, nothing very glaring in his life that prevented him from being potentially named a saint. Then in 2017, 15 years after that, Pope Francis officially declared John Paul I a venerable, approving the determination by the congregation that he had indeed lived a life of heroic virtue. Then beatification comes next, being named blessed. And as I mentioned at the outset, that's actually happening on the very day this episode releases, September 4th, 2022. The catalyst apparently was an investigation into a supposed miraculous healing of an Argentinian girl in 2017, having been determined to be beyond all medical explanation and subsequently approved by Pope Francis in the fall of 2021. But when might he be canonized? God only knows. Now, lest anyone think that the church is getting trigger happy with canonizing popes these days, I want to share some food for thought. One, I'm reminded of the line by G.K. Chesterton that each generation is converted by the saint who contradicts it most. The generation in which we live, especially if we consider it to be the past century, has been rife with more secularism, more persecution of Christians, and more anxiety and depression than any other time in human history. Now, granted, humanity suffers from different mutations of the same sin in every age, the same depravity, the same shortcomings. Heck, that's one major reason this show exists, to remind us of that. But our time is unique in the history of the world in another way. So why wouldn't we be gifted, as I'm convinced that we have been, with a sort of new golden age of the papacy, with men in the chair of Peter who, despite potentially not always being good governors or administrators, they don't have to be kings anymore either, are nevertheless men of deep and abiding humility, poverty of spirit, and virtue. I mean, don't believe me, just read more than just the surface level description of any 20th century pope, virtually, from Pius X, John XXIII, Benedict XV, Paul VI, on down to both of the John Pauls, Benedict, one will find at any rate a common thread in large part, summed up by this answer to a question on John Paul I's holiness, written by none other than Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, 2 years before he became pope. Cardinal Ratzinger said, quote, "Personally, I'm altogether convinced he was a saint because of his great goodness, simplicity, humility, and for his great courage, because he also had the courage to say things with great clarity, even going against current opinions, and also for his great culture of faith. He was not just a simple parish priest who had become patriarch by chance. He was a man of great theological culture and of great pastoral sense and experience. His writings on catechesis are precious, and his book, Illustrissimi, which I read immediately after his election, is very fine. Yes, I'm convicted that he is a saint." End quote. Now, we have just one last piece of this episode on John Paul I to share with you, a story that's likely known in its full form only by a very small sliver of people still walking the earth today, and you're about to join them. It's about a life-changing trip that the future John Paul I took to Fatima, literally just weeks before his election to the papacy. The story, in fact, was shared in the bonus section of our episode earlier this year with Father Rich Kunst, friend of the show, patron of the show, priest of the Diocese of Duluth, and he's, of course, remember, the curator of the world's largest papal artifact collection outside of the Vatican. So wanted to share that here to close out this episode. So here's that excerpt from my conversation with Father Rich. So John Paul I, I also have developed just like a very profound love for him. But I didn't realize how great of a man he was.
Yeah, he's incredible. Not a lot of biographies written about him, but I've read every one, you know, that's in English as far as I know. But let me tell you an interesting story I've got a little time if you do.
Yeah.
An interesting story because although I've not been in as close contact with her over the last decade, I would say, as I was earlier, Pia Luciani was his niece, who was more like a daughter to him. So I've actually got several letters from him to her that she gave me, you know, and so they're really intimate. And so their relationship was very, very tight as a niece and an uncle. And she told me the story that just floored me about when he went to Fatima. Now, this has gotten out there already. It's already a little bit out there. John Paul, as Cardinal Luciani, went to Fatima, I think it was in the end of 1977, to pilgrimage. And so I know I've read about this a little bit, but not to the same degree that she spoke to me about this. So she says, "My uncle was always happy. He was always joyful. He always had a smile. He was just that guy." But she said, in the end of 1978, when he went to Fatima, he came back from there and he never smiled again. He was dour. He was grumpy. He was not happy. And we all wondered, something happened. Something had to have happened. And so then she proceeds to say, in light of everything that we know now, that she thinks that Our Lady revealed to him that he would be Pope, and that he would be Pope for only a short time. And then as soon as he was elected Pope, his countenance came back, and he was a smiling, happy Pope. Mm-hmm. But she said for the 10 months or so that preceded that, he was a totally different man. Isn't that crazy? Nuts.
When I was preparing for that episode, I heard a story, like it seemed legendary the way that it was told. They're like, nobody can really verify this, that he went to Fatima and talked to Sister Lucia, I think, right?
I don't
And but then it was like they, oh yeah, that Sister Lucia told him that you're going to be Pope and you're only going to be Pope for a month or something. And that, but you know, we could verify that. That's so that's incredible.
That's not how Pia Luciani told me. Pia Luciani, her expression was that her belief was that it was the Virgin Mary revealed this to him. Whoa. And that it was not from Sister Lucia.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised.
That John Paul II never wrote, you know, like Francis doesn't put one.
Right.
But John Paul II wrote one. That's significant because, you know, I'm thinking back to my papal autograph collection. Like, I don't know how many other ones I've got, but I mean, I don't think I got two. I don't know if I've got any ones, but I mean, I think that they all refer to themselves as, you know, just their name. But mm-hmm. for John Paul II to put the first implies that he had some foreknowledge.
So how do you like that? It's been 6 or 8 months since I've heard that story, and I'm still blown away by it. Every time I hear it, every time I think of it, what an amazing thing. I mean, truth is very often stranger than fiction. It does seem to make sense. I mean, on its own merits, right? How else would you react if you were told by the Blessed Mother, hypothetically, that you only had a few months to live? But there's too many instances where he's saying, yeah, I'm not going to be around for very long, that you got to think that something happened. Anyways, so we hope you really enjoyed this this special episode, this special refresh of the story of the other Pope named John Paul. You can find coverage of his beatification if you're interested. I'm sure everywhere on the internet should be covered by EWTN, Vatican News, all the usual suspects there. We really hope you enjoyed this episode again, especially if you're a new listener, if you're an old listener. Please leave us a review, rating at iTunes and Spotify. Thank you again to all of our patrons. You can join us there at patreon.com/thepopecast. And then, of course, Today in Papal History, if you'd like to join that newsletter, another side project that we do for papal history as well, at popes.substack.com. So as we head out today, let us pray for the intercession of now blessed Pope John Paul I, that we too might be beacons of hope, of humility, of virtue, of simple joy to our neighbors. Our world really needs it. Until next time.